from Oregon to Tennessee, Utah to West Virginia, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, President Donald Trump wants European nations to pay more for their own military defense. Keith Naughton of Silent Majority Strategies is here to explain why Europe has no choice but to do so. U.S. Senator Jean Shaheen of New Hampshire has announced her retirement, setting up a key battle for 2026. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with a real story. Social Security is headed toward insolvency. Dead people on the rolls are only a small part of the problem. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains. And Donald Trump is moving fast and breaking things, but that can be a dangerous strategy when challenging the international balance of power. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The United States has been subsidizing Europe's military defense for decades. Now President Trump wants them to pay a larger share of the cost. They have no choice but to go along. Keith Naughton is principal at Silent Majority Strategies and a frequent contributor to The Hill. He is here now to explain why. Keith, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Keith, you began your recent piece in The Hill talking about United States' relationship with Europe, and you started your piece saying the basic fact of the matter is that Europe has no good alternative to making every attempt to salvage some partnership with America and Trump. What led you to that conclusion?
Well, I think it's both economics and security. I mean, when it comes to economics, in the world of trade, for lack of a better term, opposites attract, which is countries running surpluses need to match themselves up with countries running deficits, whether it's overall or in different sort of product categories. You know, China's running a $1 trillion merchandise trade surplus with the world. And they're running their largest, of course, with the United States, but they're running a big trade surplus, again, merchandise goods surplus with Europe. So if Europe were to try to match up with China, well, that doesn't make any sense. They're not going to be able to sell their stuff there because Europe is also a merchandise trade surplus country. With the United States, we're actually running a services surplus with other parts of the world. So in a way, there's a little bit of a balance for us that people don't talk about that much. But we're the country that's taking in these products from the world. Europe needs to sell them. They're not going to be able to sell them to China. China's already made a policy shift, made it years ago, to try to move up the value chain to be more high-tech products. I mean, I'm sure China would love to partner with Europe if Europe was making cheap stuff for Temu and Shein, and China was making all the expensive, sophisticated equipment. But that kind of gets beside the point for Europe. So the United States and Europe are more natural trade partners. Europe and China are not natural trade partners at all. So that makes no sense. And the Europeans, they simply aren't able to defend themselves. From a security standpoint, their militaries are completely atrophied. They've shown no willingness to truly build a larger defense capability. They talk a lot about it, but there's still a sort of a squabbling mass of different countries with different interest groups. So they're going to have a very difficult time replacing the United States on the economic front or on the security front.
President Trump, of course, here, Keith, is pushing real hard for Europe to begin paying more of the cost of their own security and defense needs. At this point, do they really have, as you pointed out, do they really have much of a choice but to start anteing up a little bit more? Because I think the president's very, very serious that America's still not going to have an open checkbook for Europe.
Well, I think that is a tough question because the Europeans are, they haven't shown any willingness. They've been hectored by American presidents for decades to do this. It's only Trump that's actually put some teeth behind it And of course, the Russian invasion of Ukraine has sort of brought to the fore what happens when you decide to unilaterally disarm yourself. It only brings trouble for yourself. But I think that the issue with the Europeans is, in addition, is they've got a fiscal problem. You know, France and Italy have enormous fiscal deficits, enormous national debt. Germany is relatively low, but they have a constitutional brake on spending, but their economy is not growing, so they're not generating revenue to engage in more investment. And the Europeans are stuck in the euro. So unlike the United States, where we're able to borrow on our own currency, where we're able to expand the deficit when we need to, the Europeans are much more constrained by that. And one of the interesting things, and I wrote about this a couple weeks ago, about Europe's problem with the euro is, when you're in this fiscal problem, where you're in this fiscal straitjacket, when you've got a stagnant economy, and when you've got a debt issue, austerity is one of the worst things you can do. Sort of as bad as devaluing your currency is, and that's no fun either, it's far worse to engage in austerity. And the Europeans are going to be facing that unless they're able to expand their debt limit, which the euro restricts. They're stuck in this fiscal straitjacket that's going to make it very difficult for them to expand on to meet their security obligations.
So we have this situation both economically and militarily with Europe. The further problem here, Keith, the Trump administration in dealing with it, there's not really one unified place to go. I mean, the European Union seems rather feckless. So who does Trump even begin to negotiate to get out of this situation?
I mean, that's another huge problem. I mean, Henry Kissinger once said, if you need to negotiate with Europe, who do you call? There's no one specific to call. Macron, the president of France, has tried to take that mantle on, but the other larger European countries get resentful of that. So I think it's a real challenge that there's no central decision maker. There's no consensus. And we've seen this problem in the last 40 years, and actually stretches back even further. Europe has shown absolutely no ability to satisfy any of its geopolitical issues without American help. And that's been the case for over 100 years. The United States has been bailing out Europe since 1917 continuously because they can't take care of their own affairs. And they've shown no ability to make that change. So I think Trump has really laid down the law to say there's going to be no more bailouts and Europe is going to struggle that situation.
Keith Naughton is principal of Silent Majority Strategies. He also writes frequently in The Hill. And Keith, how can folks find your writings?
You can find me on thehill.com. I'm about every other week on Thursday. So check it out, please.
Keith Naughton of Silent Majority Strategies. Keith, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. This week, we're going to take a look at some key U.S. Senate and gubernatorial races shaping up for 2026 because there's been some developments this past week. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman.
Let us start out a retirement, I believe the first retirement to be announced for the 2026 cycle. Want to fill us in on who is retiring, where, and the impact?
Well, it's the first Democrat to announce their retirement. We also had Mitch McConnell earlier this year formally declare that he will not seek re-election, and that big Kentucky race that's shaping up with Nate Morris and possibly Andy Barr, and not to mention Daniel Cameron, who had won attorney general race there and lost his race for governor against Andy Beshear. But this week, Jeanne Shaheen, who is a member that I think was elected in the 2008 class with the Democrats, she announced that she will not seek re-election for the United States Senate seat in New Hampshire. And, you know, this is one of those races that a couple of big dogs are looking at running on the Republican side, and it'll be exciting to see if we can get a top-tier candidate to flip that seat and enhance the Republican majority. We're talking about former Governor Chris Sununu, being, I think, the front-runner candidate. If he chooses to run, I think he would almost completely clear the field and, you know, get a lot of national attention from the donor class and from the committees. I think he'd be a top recruit for the National Republican Senatorial Committee in Tim Scott. And then the other candidate is a former U.S. Senator from another state, Scott Brown. You might remember Scott Brown because after Ted Kennedy passed away, Scott Brown won the special election that ultimately prevented the Democrats from having a 60-seat majority in the United States Senate. It was, you know, a unique example where in Massachusetts we elected a Republican, right? But that can happen in special elections. Obviously, this is, we're looking at a primary. And the unique thing about New Hampshire is that this is a really, really late primary. The primary is not until September of 2006. So when you know it's going to be a big, expensive general election race, I have a feeling that they're going to do their best to clear the field early and not have, you know, two big Republicans, you know, duking it out here for 18 months before we can get going toward the general election. I would imagine that they can clear the field with one of the candidates.
Meanwhile, over in the state of Michigan, Scott, we have an open seat, but we have a big name decided he's not going to seek the Senate seat. Who is that, and what's the impact there?
Gary Peters announced that he's not going to seek re-election in Michigan either, and there's been a lot of rumors about Mayor Pete, the former Secretary of Transportation, having moved to Michigan with his husband. He announced this week he's actually going to take a pass on it and not run for the United States Senate. And with Mayor Pete not running, it's going to be a big open race. We'll figure out who the Republican nominee is going to be, but that's absolutely one of the targets that Republicans want to pick up. It'll be a challenge because Donald Trump picked up the sort of forgotten voter, the soft Democrat. And, you know, the history shows it's difficult to maintain that, you know, enthusiasm for a midterm election after your party's won the White House.
There also is going to be an open seat for governor in Michigan. Buttigieg looking at that, or is he just going to take a pass on 2026?
Well, we're not quite sure for that. You know, there's a bunch of Democrats that I think are looking at running or have declared, and they are, you know, big-time statewide candidates already, including Michigan's Secretary of State, Jocelyn Benson. I think you're going to see a lot of Democrats that try to rally behind her. You also have a guy named Garland Gilchrist, and he's the current lieutenant governor of Michigan. So if Mayor Pete decides to get in that race, he's definitely not going to clear the field. And I think he'd be running, you know, really a bruising primary against two statewide elected officials. So that one's probably not the best option for him. But, you know, we've got other big gubernatorial races all throughout the country. This week, the Club for Growth announced our endorsement of Byron Donalds in the state of Florida for governor. Byron is 100% on the Club for Growth PAC scorecard and has just been a tremendous leader in the House. We're excited to be supporting him. I think he'll be a tremendous governor.
There are other gubernatorial races. A couple of weeks ago, Scott, we did talk about the fact we have two races for governor this year in Virginia and New Jersey. Looking around the country, do you see other major states, particularly states that are swing states, that are going to have very competitive races for governor next year?
So you have a re-election for the governor of Nevada. You've got an open seat in Ohio where Vivek Ramaswamy is running, and I think he will be the next governor of Ohio. You've got a big race actually in Kansas, of all places, where there's a Democrat governor, but we have a real shot with a strong Republican candidate. I think that primary will be competitive. Jeff Collier is one of those candidates. You've got races in areas like Tennessee, where Marsha Blackburn is expected to run. You've got a big race, an open seat in Wyoming where Mark Gordon is term limited. And, you know, a number of people are looking at running, including potentially Harriet Hageman, who is currently in the United States House of Representatives representing the entire state in an at-large district. You've got, you know, I'm bouncing around here all over the country, if it makes sense. But even a race in Wisconsin where, Eric Hovde was our United States Senate nominee, lost a really close race to Tammy Baldwin in November. He's considering running in Wisconsin, and so is Tom Tiffany, a U.S. congressman from the 7th District. You know, that'd be a competitive primary. I think that, you know, both of those guys are sort of testing the waters right now. Neither has declared their intention. But, you know, Wisconsin, again, one of these states like Michigan, where President Trump performed well. What does 2026 look like? And can we actually flip these seats? It's going to be really exciting. We know that there's a lot of big races ahead of us.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the Club for Growth and where can we find you on the web?
Club for Growth is united in that idea of economic freedom, opportunity, and liberty. If anybody wants to check us out, the website is clubforgrowth.org. You can sign up for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
You're welcome.
Elon Musk has uncovered a significant number of dead Americans still collecting Social Security. And while that certainly is a problem, the system suffers from more systemic difficulties, as we learn now from Eric Boehm of Reason magazine.
At last week's joint address to Congress, President Donald Trump spent a few minutes talking about how some very old people are apparently still part of the Social Security database. Believe it or not, he said, government databases list 4.7 million Social Security members from people aged 100 to 109 years old. It also lists 3.6 million people from ages 110 to 119. The president went on to say, "I don't know any of them. I know some people who are rather elderly, but not quite that elderly." And then he continued. He said that money is still being paid to many of them. And he said that his Department of Government Efficiency, run by Elon Musk, of course, is now searching through those databases to find people, some of them as old as 150 or 160 years old, to make sure that Social Security payments are not going to them, to those people who are in all likelihood no longer alive. Because that's the implication here, of course, that those people are long dead and that Social Security is still paying out those benefits to, well, someone. Now, maybe it's all fraud, but the truth is actually, in all likelihood, a bit more complicated. Indeed, it's not the dead that are bankrupting Social Security, but the living. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. So when President Trump says that there's all of these people aged 110 or 120 or 150, when he says they are still on the Social Security rolls, that's accurate. But that's not actually the same thing as saying that they are getting benefits. And more to the point, those who are getting benefits at those advanced ages, because they're super old or because of fraud or whatever, make up a tiny, tiny portion of all Social Security payouts. So let's take a closer look at those two facts. Back in July of 2023, the Social Security Administration's Inspector General released a report showing that 18.9 million individuals born in 1920 or before did not have a date of death in the program's database. And that total included nearly 11 million people born in 1899 or earlier. Now, the oldest person believed to be living in America today is Naomi Whitehead, a Georgia woman born in 1910. It is a very safe bet that everyone who lived during the year 1899 is now long dead. The crucial question, however, is whether Social Security's lack of quote-unquote death information about those people means they are still receiving benefits. The vast majority of them are not. According to that same Inspector General's report, 98% of that population are not currently receiving Social Security payments. That's because those 18 million people have not had earnings reported to Social Security in the past 50 years, according to the Inspector General. And the fact that these people are over age 100 and have not had any earnings in the past 50 years and have received no Social Security payments indicates to the Social Security Administration that they are deceased. Even so, I think it's fair to ask the next logical question. Why are all of these probably dead people on the Social Security rolls in the first place? And mostly the answer is that they died before electronic record keeping existed, and the government bureaucracy has little incentive or ability to fix that problem. That same Inspector General report estimates that it would cost between $5.5 million and $9.7 million to fix those discrepancies in the database. When a similar report was published in 2015, the Social Security Administration declined to do anything about it because of the expected cost. And because the administration believed that a new regulation would be required to allow it to add death information to those records that don't have any death information attached to them. So on one hand, this is actually a bit of a funny commentary about the state of the federal bureaucracy, right? The Social Security Administration literally says that it cannot acknowledge reality. It can't say all of these people who must be dead are dead because there's no regulation allowing them to do so. And that's just typical government bureaucraties for you. But the problem is actually a bit more complicated. See, if you don't have the quote-unquote death information, you don't have the death certificate, you don't have the ability to actually enter that information into the database about these 18 million people, and if that information can't be sourced anywhere, then these bureaucrats would be quite literally implementing fraud. They would be quite literally filling in fraudulent death information if they were to update the database, and thus they are understandably unwilling to do it. Now, of course, there's almost certainly some fraudulent payments going out the door. Any big government bureaucracy is susceptible to fraud, and Social Security is no different. And it follows from that that cleaning up the Social Security database is a worthwhile thing to do. But Social Security's biggest problem isn't the stuff that Trump was talking about in that address to Congress. It isn't payments to the dead or the likely dead. It is payments to the living. Last year, Social Security distributed more than $1.4 trillion in benefits to about 68 million Americans. Current workers had a little less than $1.3 trillion extracted from their paychecks to fund the program. 1.4 is, of course, bigger than 1.3. Obviously, that math is not balanced. And last year was no exception. Social Security has been running annual deficits since 2010. And the average Social Security recipient collects significantly more in benefits than he or she contributed in payroll taxes over the course of their career. That's why Social Security is spiraling towards insolvency, which it will hit sometime in the mid-2030s. When it does, beneficiaries will have their checks automatically trimmed by about 20%. Cleaning up the program's databases and rooting out fraud is, of course, a worthwhile thing to do. But the problem with Social Security is not secret. It's not the fact that there's all of these fraud, all of these old, probably dead people getting payments. The problem with Social Security is that it's an outdated program designed for a very different era that's currently providing overly generous benefits to the wealthiest cohort of retirees in American history. Fixing those problems will require much more than simply cutting off mostly non-existent benefit payments to people who are dead. It will require phasing out Social Security or significantly restructuring the program to give younger workers better options to save for retirement and means testing benefits so the government can stop robbing relatively poorer workers to fund the lavish retirements of wealthy seniors. But of course, all of that is much tougher to squeeze into an applause line in an address to Congress. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of Social Security, of the Trump administration, and of everything going on around the country this week at Reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Donald Trump is rightfully challenging the world's power structure, but moving too fast can have serious consequences. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
There's a saying in the fast world of Silicon Valley, move fast and break things. Donald Trump has adopted it as if it were his own. Now, in the world of technology, it makes a certain amount of sense. It basically assumes that something truly innovative has been invented and that it will be utterly disruptive to the environment in which it will be introduced. When that's the case, moving fast is essential. And if you break things on your way to establish the disruptive new concept, well, that's just the way something new breaks onto the scene. Does what works in the wild jungle of technological innovation also apply to the staid and serious world of international diplomacy? Donald Trump thinks so. He enjoys moving fast, and if he breaks things along the way, so what? But the stakes are higher in diplomacy, and the risk of breaking things can be catastrophic. The credit for coining the term move fast and break things belongs to Mark Zuckerberg in the early days of Facebook. It was also the title of a 2017 book by Jonathan Taplin with the subtitle How Facebook, Google, and Amazon Have Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. But even undermining democracy, as serious a threat as that might be, isn't as potentially catastrophic as destabilizing the world order among nuclear powers. There are now 9 nuclear nations: the U.S., Russia, the U.K., France, Israel, India, China, Pakistan, and North Korea. Iran is on the cusp of becoming the 10th. There is a kind of dynamic tension among them today, and NATO plays a crucial role in maintaining that fragile equilibrium. Donald Trump's insistence on member countries paying a fair share of NATO's cost is a bold and positive factor, but it is unfortunately coupled with a naive lack of appreciation for the role the treaty has played in resisting Russian aggression in Eastern Europe for 75 years. If NATO were to become one of the things that break as a consequence of Trump's brash attempts to reset the balance of power in the Russian war against Ukraine, then literally no one knows what might happen. Would Vladimir Putin take another step towards restoring the scope of the Russian Empire by invading Poland, Lithuania, or the Baltic states? Most European heads of state consider that a real risk. Trump also moved fast and didn't mind breaking things when he announced his plan to redevelop Gaza. Here are his exact words from the news conference with an obviously startled Benjamin Netanyahu. Quote, "The only reason that Palestinians want to go back to Gaza is they have no alternative. Right now it's a demolition site. This is just a demolition site. Virtually every building is down. They're living under fallen concrete that's very dangerous and very precarious. They instead can occupy all of a beautiful area with homes and safety, and they can live out their lives in peace and harmony instead of having to go back and do it again. The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip, and we will do a job with it too. We'll own it and be responsible for dismantling all of the dangerous unexploded bombs and other weapons on the site, level the site, get rid of the destroyed buildings, level it out, create an economic development that will supply unlimited numbers of jobs and housing for the people of the area. Do a real job. Do something different." Unquote. That's a pretty arrogant perspective to take on one of the world's perennial trouble spots. Fortunately, over the following weeks, he modified and softened this proposal, but the point is, he really wanted to move fast and break things. Certainly, the initiatives undertaken by Elon Musk and his Department of Government Efficiency are in the same mold, and it's becoming increasingly clear that moving fast and breaking things like federal government departments and entitlement programs are on a very different scale than introducing a new device like a smartphone or a disruptive social media tool like Twitter. Voting with Russia and North Korea and failing to condemn Russia for invading Ukraine threatens almost all of the alliances that the U.S. has participated in since the end of World War II and has the potential to trigger a World War III. Moving fast and breaking things is a cute slogan for a product introduction strategy in the technology industry. It is not responsible policy on a national or international scale. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WBBZ-AM in Ponca City, Oklahoma, KMGZ-FM in Lawton, Oklahoma, along with KCLC-FM in St. Charles, Missouri. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal. lighting the brush fires of freedom.